This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and we start today with the latest in our Budget Boston series, where we talk about thriving in expensive Boston on a budget. So we asked you if you had questions about setting financial goals in 2023 or financial planning, and wow, did you ever. So listen, if you have more questions, you can still ask them now. If you're in our texting group, send them in, 617-766-0382. Or you can tweet at us. We're at Radio Boston. I'm just going to choke on the volume of questions coming in there. With us to help answer this all, Paul LaPiana, head of product for MassMutual in the U.S., also worked as a certified financial planner for over two decades. Paul, thank you for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
So we're going to jump in here with a series of true or false questions. I understand everything is nuanced, yep. Right? But let's just get some basics.
Okay.
Is it true that you have to spend money to make money?
No.
Okay. Can you only save money if you make a lot?
No.
Financial goal setting and planning, only for people with lots of extra money around?
100% not.
You can't save money while you're paying down debt.
False.
The smartest way to save as a couple is to combine finances.
Maybe.
You can't buy a house with high student debt.
No. False.
All credit card debt is bad.
False.
And the only way to bring up your credit score is by paying down debt.
False.
All right. So this is the kind of stuff we're going to dive into now. And I am impressed with the speed of those answers. Yeah. Very nice. Okay. So let's
I don't know if they're all right.
We're going to try, though. So let's start with financial planning.
Yep.
And first, what does a financial planner do?
So it's interesting. So I have a CFP, been in the industry for about 30 years.
CFP stands for Certified.
Certified Financial Planner. So it's a designation. Been in the industry for about 30 years, was an advisor for eight. And I have a financial advisor for our family. And the reason is making sure you have a well-thought-out plan that is something that keeps you on track and makes you intentional and thoughtful about your money decisions is super important. Financial planning is also a very dynamic process because there's a lot of things that are going to change in your life, having kids, buying houses, going on vacations, emergencies, and you need somebody that you trust that can help you navigate those complexities. And in my world, I hire somebody to do it because I'm in the business and can't know everything.
So a listener would say, well, yeah, you do because you can afford it and you know what you're doing. How can I afford a financial planner?
So it's interesting. I think that's a really good question. And there's different types of financial planners. Some you have to pay a fee for, and that might be a little bit out of some people's budget. There's other advisors that are commission-based, and you're not going to pay a fee to do business with them. They are going to get compensated based on the products that they implement when you do the plan.
So they make their money by what you invest in.
You got it. And I started my career that way, and we actually used to give away the plan. So we used a financial plan, did all the same things that a fee-based planner would do, but we didn't feel like the audience we were sitting in front of had the money to write a check for the plan. So we got paid on the investments, the insurance, and the other things that were part of the implementation.
And what's the most common question a financial planner gets?
So why should I hire you? What is the value that you bring to the table? And it's interesting because until you've worked with one and a good one, you wouldn't know. Right. So it's like one of those things that's scary for individuals to jump into that conversation. But I think of our planner like he's literally like part of the family and he's more like a coach for us versus doing just the financial advice and guidance.
And can people budget and plan without hiring a financial planner?
They can. But the problem is because there's so many things that are intersected, like you have, should I put money in my 401k? Should it be pre-tax or a Roth, right? There is
Roth is a form of IRA.
You got it. Should I be putting money into a 529 plan for my college?
Which is the college
savings plan. Right? So there's a lot of these choices. And what happens is most people don't have enough discretionary income to take care of it all. So you got to prioritize it. And one of the things I always, and I'm talking to my kids that just graduated college now, and when they look at their paycheck after tax, they're like, oh my gosh, this is not as much as I thought. And I said, but the better news is you get to save 10% of that starting right now.
For
retirement or long-term savings. Because one of the things you always want to do is pay yourself first. The other thing is consistency and frequency and being disciplined. And then time value of money. The more you can save early on in your life, as you get older, it's a huge payoff to you.
So AJ and Quincy is part of our texting group, and you can join our texting group if you haven't already by texting the word Boston to 617-766-0382. AJ says, "Hi, living in Boston area is very expensive, and while I'm mindful of how I spend my money, this new year I want to learn easy ways to build a budget and monitor my expenses.
Yep.
Do you have any recommendations for a free app, website, or budget tracker for individuals who want to track expenses?"
So what I would say is there, like literally you Google what AJ just said, and there's going to be a number of things that come up as it relates to budgeting. I do encourage you, AJ, if you could, is seek out an advisor. There are people that will help you because things that you think might be important but are unaware of, somebody else can bring in some outside advice and guidance to help you be more thoughtful with how you're budgeting and then how you actually spend your discretionary money. So I do really highly believe somebody from the outside would be a great partner for you.
WBUR's business reporter Yasmin Ammer has a question for you. I'll play it for you.
Yeah. So the first is you got to start. Secondly, if I was starting out and I hadn't been investing at this point, I would look at my employment situation because most employers have a 401k. Most employers are making a match on that 401k, and that is basically contributions to your retirement from other people's money, and you can't get any better benefit. So most 401ks are going to be pre-tax, tax-deferred. Your employer will make a contribution that's pre-tax, tax-deferred, and that means you're not paying tax on the growth along the way, which allows the money to accumulate faster. So I would say start there. If you don't have that, look at an IRA, traditional IRA.
Individual retirement account.
You got it. And then the other thing that is, it's interesting about savings, it is about consistency and it is about discipline. And there's a lot of studies that show if you just save 10% of your income every single year, you will be independently wealthy. And that's kind of the discipline that I would put on people. And that goes back to one of the questions on should I pay down debt or should I start saving? The answer is yes and yes, right? Because if you wait to pay down debt, what happens is revolving debt is a thing that is really common in people's lives. And a lot of times they never are done with debt. And that means they never started their savings.
Okay, so let's talk about real scarcity. You've got $2 left. And that's an example. You've got $2 left and you can either put a dollar each, right? Or with just $2, do you pay down debt first or do you save first? If you're really dealing with scarcity.
Yeah. So if you have extremely high interest debt, obviously people are going to say you pay that down.
So like credit card debt.
Yeah. That might be even this interest rate environment a lot higher than what it was, right? But I go back to you want to do both if you actually can. The other thing I want to go back to the prior question is most people are emotional about investing, and with the stock market down and the bond market down, when is the best time to buy? Is right now. People are scared to be entering into the volatility, but if you have a long-term horizon, you want to be buying when it's low, not when it's high. And typically the retail investor is chasing returns and they're moving money on what has just done well. And that means you're buying at the high point, not at the low point.
So the retail investor being the average person
you
who's doing it on their own. Okay, so we've got a question from Jane in Scituate, also a member of our texting group. And listen, you can add us on Twitter right now if you have questions, or if you're a member of our texting group, send that question now, 617-766-0382. So Jane says, what programs, if any, exist for first-time homebuyers with no savings? After rent, groceries, transportation, healthcare, et cetera, I have no money to put in a savings account. How will I ever be able to buy something of my own and get out of the renter cycle?
Yeah. So what I would say is when you're thinking about buying a house for the first time, there are federal and local loan programs that are, let's call it, more friendly on what you need to do for a deposit and what you have in a credit score. So I think a couple things there is look at what those are and see which one may be a better fit for you. I think the other thing is be realistic as well. You know, you've got to think about buying a home, how much and when, and then back to discipline is figuring out how you start saving appropriately so that you can actually come up with whatever that down payment is for your price range.
So let's stay on this. WBUR business reporter Yasmin Ammer spoke with David McCarthy, who's the incoming president of the Massachusetts Association of Realtors, who said next year is supposed to be another frustrating house hunting year. Supply in the state about a quarter of what's considered a typically balanced and healthy housing market.
But we're really not seeing that price adjustment. And we're not seeing the price adjustment, I think, simply because inventory is so remarkably low right now. We're still seeing at times, depending upon the product, multiple offers, really surprisingly.
So Yasmin says, on behalf of listeners, should I buy a house? And how much house is too much house? Is there a formula I can use?
And you know what? I think that the question of should I buy a house is really, you know, let's call it the individual's decision on, is this something that they want to be investing in long term? The American dream of owning a home has shifted compared to when my parents and grandparents thought that was the first thing they needed to do. So I think that really depends. I do think that you also should seek some advice and guidance outside. The other thing is there are some formulas on how much your mortgage should be of your adjusted gross income. And there's differences in opinions on that. But I think that, you know, you want to make sure that you're not overspending so that you are not in a situation where you're house poor. And then everything else that is going on in your life is not able to function appropriately, like saving for your kids' college, like saving for retirement. So I think that's where an advisor can step in and actually help you sort through that.
When is credit card debt not bad?
You know what? If you have emergencies and you actually don't have an emergency fund, like credit card's gonna work. If you've got, you know, the ability to buy something on credit and pay it off in a relatively short period of time. So it allows you to, let's maybe bridge the gap on certain income or bonuses. That's not good. I think where you run
that's
into-
That's not bad.
That's not bad. I'm sorry. Where you run into problems is when people are buying things that they shouldn't be buying at this stage in their life, and then they're carrying this debt for a long time. The interest payments that you're incurring are high and you're paying minimums. And that's where you end up getting into a bad situation. Yep, exactly.
So our newsroom gathered questions for us as well. And here's one that they gave us to ask. And this is close to the end here. How do I become more financially literate in ways that don't feel overwhelming or are free? Any recommendation for accounts to follow on social, books to read, skills to brush up on?
Yeah, so it's interesting. There are a lot of really good companies like a MassMutual, like a Fidelity, like an Ameriprise, that you go to their websites and you will find amazing information that is really in simple terms for people to understand how to become more financial literate. I think the thing I would warn people is if you go just to your browser and you start, you know, Googling things, it gets very confusing very quickly. So there's so much information that you end up getting the white noise and it freezes you. So I would go to one of those trusted brands out there, start messing around with their websites. They have calculators on there. They've got good information. It's in very basic terms. And then at the end of the day, most of them say, if you want an advisor, click here. You know, the one thing I would also say, because I've been over talking about advisors because I really do believe in them, is I would look at people that are mentors, people that you trust that are doing things well, and I would ask them for referrals.
Interesting. Interesting. All right. Paul LaPiana is head of product for MassMutual in the U.S. and a certified financial planner who's been in the industry for about 3 decades. Paul, super helpful. Thank you.
Thank you.
I will love that song until the day I die. Opening notes to Dolly Parton's classic, 9 to 5. The song originally debuted as the title track to a movie starring Parton, Lily Tomlin, and Jane Fonda as a trio of office workers who conspire to undermine a chauvinistic boss.
What about you, Dorley? What's your fantasy for doing him in?
Me? Well, I think I'd like to just come riding up one day and give him a taste of his own medicine.
So that is Tomlin and Parton there. The film is funny, it's wacky, it's weirdly fictional and not, in a way that only a movie from 1980 can be, but it takes its inspiration from a very real labor group, also called 9 to 5, that started here in Boston 50 years ago, when Ellen Cassidy helped found the group. She is here with us in Studio 2 today to talk about her new book. It's called Working 9 to 5, and it traces the movement for women's rights in the workplace over the course of a half a century to the present day. Ellen, welcome.
Thank you so much.
So we also have here in studio two additional guests. Renee Dozier is with the Electricians Union IBEW Local 103, and Carrie Barbash is the president of the Harvard Union of Clerical and Technical Workers. Renee, welcome to you.
Thank you.
And Carrie, welcome.
Thank you.
So I'm going to start over here with Ellen and ask some questions about this book. And, you know, I consider myself fairly well-informed about the history of women in the second half of the 20th century. I could write my own book about what I didn't know, Ellen, that is in this book. Is this hidden history?
Well, when we got started 50 years ago, working women who worked in offices were basically kind of invisible. When people pictured a worker, they would picture a man wearing a hard hat wielding a wrench. But there were 20 million women office workers out there. We were flooding into the workplace. And there was a bubbling sense of discontent, and that's when 9 to 5 got started here in Boston. 10 of us started sitting around talking about our jobs, low pay, unequal pay, training bosses to be our own supervisors, and having to do favors, all kinds of favors for men.
So I want to play a little sound then from the movie 9 to 5, Lily Tomlin's character talking here.
I report directly to Mr. Hart. That's his office over there. He was just made vice president. I have never seen anyone leapfrog so fast to the top in my life. And I have the bad back to prove it. I remember when he was just a management trainee. In fact, I'm the one who trained him.
And there was this litany, Ellen, right, of these kinds of complaints. You know, it wasn't just that you trained your next boss. It's that you were always only going to train your next boss. And the money was never going to come. And the respect was never going to be there. And the harassment was going to be intense.
And that's what we started to change. It wasn't long before we started handing out a newsletter all over Boston. We ended up winning millions of dollars in back pay and raises from big banks and insurance companies. And we got government agencies working on our behalf. We started a woman-led union, and we made countless bosses get their own coffee.
All right, so the last thing before I bring in Renee and Carrie, I love that. The other thing that struck me, I mean, there were many things that struck me in the book, was that we had three big industries that were kind of the heart of white-collar Boston in the 1970s, universities, finance, and publishing. And so that's where you started, because this was the place that women, you could organize women to break through there. But those wound up having ripple effects through all sort of related industries across the country. Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, well, we targeted the biggest bank, the biggest insurance company. We went out to universities. We got publishing to really make changes in career ladders and job posting and job training for women. And it affected not just women in the office, but also everyone who worked in the office. And our mantra was that we didn't want to just get women out of the typing pool. We wanted to make life in the typing pool better. So, yes, the news began to spread, and women all over started to stand up for their rights. There was one tiny office where the women got together, and they had the nerve to start circulating a petition. And their boss caught them at it. He held up the petition, held it over the trash can, and he said, "You know what we do with these things? They go right in the trash." 3 days later, they won all their demands.
Amazing. All right, so let's turn to Renee Dozier now with the Electricians Union IBEW Local 103. Renee, do you see a direct line from the stories Ellen is talking about from 50 years ago and the role and the work you're doing now?
A direct line? I would say that evolution is here, right? We're evolving, and when I first got in the union 20-plus years ago, things are different now. We have so many more women in the trades, and the guys think twice about asking you how'd you get here, or who do you know, or thinking that, you know, you're not an actual tradesperson, electrician or plumber, et cetera, you know? So relationships have changed all that. Like, I remember when I first got on a job, the guys did not want me there, you know, but once they got to know me and they seen that I was a hardworking person, just same as them, just trying to provide for my family. And then the hardworking aspect is what gives you respect. And they and when I learned that you can be mad all you want, but when you get in relationship with folks, then things change.
So, Carrie, I'll turn to you. You're the president of the Harvard Union of Clerical and Technical Workers. In reading Ellen's book, there was a time when women just weren't in unions, didn't have representation. Here you are, president of a union. Did you feel a path wide open to you to ascend to where you are now?
Yes, I would say I did. It's been a real honor learning more about Ellen's story and talking to Renee, and I feel like I never felt that sort of every path wasn't open to me. And we have a majority women union. At any given time, we have 60-70% women in our union. And women are a huge part of the Harvard workforce at every level. And it feels like a lot of the of course, we all still experience sexism, but it's in a more subtle way. Things like, you know, of course, we've all been in situations where women and men are in meetings and men talk over you or say the same point you did as if you hadn't said it before. And, you know, there's obviously still a lot of work to be done, but I absolutely have felt like folks like Ellen have really cleared the way for people like me and my coworkers to really move into the roles that we have. It's been pretty amazing.
What are the key issues that are important to you right now in your work?
So right now, specifically, I'd say pay. we're in contract negotiations, actually, HUCTW, Harvard Union of Clerical and Technical Workers, with Harvard. And just like everyone in the U.S., we've been hit really hard as a membership by inflation, and we are in the kind of salary ranges where, you know, food goes up, childcare goes up, rent goes up. It really hits you hard. You don't have necessarily savings that you can draw on, and you wind up going deep into debt to just kind of pay your monthly bills. So we're in contract negotiations with Harvard trying to get raises that just keep up with inflation. And I think that's, you know, where many working people, that's their core issue.
Renee Dozier of IBEW Local 103, you're nodding to that.
I am, because to be in a room with even you ladies, it's empowering. And it's just so much, being in this position in this union, like 99% of the women that are licensed in this state are in IBEW. So that tells you that we have the pathway. There's nothing that we can't be, do, or have. We have women contractors, foremen, stewards. I'm a business agent. Like, it's amazing. So I was just walking down the street here, coming here, and I seen leaflets on the poles for unions. And I'm like, yes, yes, young people, let's do this. Let's go, because this is the way to go.
So I want to pick up a little sound on that, and then I'm going to turn back to you, Ellen. And I wish listeners could see the joy on your face as you listen to Renee and Carrie talk. So a few months ago, we had Spencer Costigan, one of the leaders of the Starbucks strike on Comm Ave, which is like, you know, eight doors down, mm-hmm. on the show. And Spencer said cost of living was at the very top of the list of reasons why workers at the Starbucks ended up striking for more than 2 months.
Most of them are making about $15 an hour, which is just not tenable for Massachusetts and Boston especially.
So I want to think about this then and now, Ellen, because you write in the book about the fact that wages weren't keeping up with cost of living then. It was part of the work of 9 to 5 to change that. So here you see Renee talking about the long-term opportunity and change that has come over the last 50 years. And you see Carrie talking about an issue that was one of the core issues you were fighting for 50 years ago. So there's a fascinating both and going on with that. How does that make you feel, and what do you find yourself thinking about that?
Yeah, well, we won a lot. We really did, but we didn't win at all. We did win the fact that some issues that used to be considered individual issues are now matters of policy, pregnancy discrimination is illegal. Sexual harassment is illegal. We don't have help wanted male and help wanted female ads in the newspapers anymore. And a lot of kinds of jobs have opened up to women that were closed in the past. But in some ways, it's harder to be a working person today than it was 50 years ago. In the gig economy, some people are working two and three jobs to put food on the table. Fewer people have regular schedules and pensions and vacations. There's computerized monitoring, relentless schedules. But the really great thing is the surge of workplace activism that we're seeing today among restaurant workers and retail workers and warehouse workers and grad students and more. And more people today support unions than have in two generations. So I feel full of hope. I really do. And I feel like these women are standing on the shoulders of people who came before, just as we did in 9 to 5. We stood on the shoulders of the early garment workers in the early 20th century. And, you know, it goes on. And there's an old labor song that says, every generation's got to win it again. And that's true. So it's really gratifying to me to see people carrying things forward.
So, Carrie, you were nodding, not in the every generation has to win it again, but the part before about, you know, standing on the shoulders of the people that came before us. Whose shoulders are you standing on, and who do you hope will be standing on your shoulders one day?
Oh, gosh.
just a little simple question for you, Carrie, nothing too deep.
Well, you know, I think I'm standing on Ellen's shoulders, and you know, the people who started our union, folks like Chris Rondeau, Bill Yeager, Marie Manna. There's so many people who, even though it doesn't feel that long ago, things were really different, and they've won so much and cleared the path so well for so that there are so many things we don't have to think about anymore. We don't have to worry about. But unfortunately, as Ellen said, we didn't win at all. And I love seeing all the organizing that's happening among Starbucks workers and graduate students. I just saw the BU Graduate Student Union won their organizing drive, won their vote. That's fantastic. So I think I hope that the work that I'm doing, that all of us, that Renee and Ellen and I are doing, are it helps to empower other people in all types of jobs to unionize, because I think, as Ellen said, unions are more popular than ever. And I think people are it's becoming back into fashion to kind of see what unions can do for you in your workplace.
So two things. First, I do want to note Boston University holds the license for WBUR as a public radio station. You made reference to the union at Boston University, and we do have a union at WBUR. So just for revealing on both of those things. Great. So, Rachel, I'm zeroing in on this idea that there's more support, using Ellen's words, more support for unions now in America than any time in the last two generations. But there are still people who feel that unions hurt small business. They drive up prices. They make it harder for people in an economy like this one to make ends meet. Is there anything fair in that criticism? What do you say to people who still say, I worry that in the long runs, unions make it harder for people who aren't in unions?
I say that unions, we have established a standard, right? And non-unions, when they come on jobs, certain developers and companies have to pay these wages that unions have. We established that. So we work hard to make sure that it's a living wage for people, for that it's safe, that certain criteria are made that for safety and numbers as far as people of color and women. But as far as I know what you're saying, we organize all the time, even small shops, right? And when you win, we win. So we can do this together. So we have our workforce. We have a 5-year apprenticeship. So you don't have to go out there and find, you know, going on Indeed and spend $1,000 to find folks. Like, we have resources to help you thrive in the union. So when the small companies win, we win. Like, we want to see you in with us, and we want to see you win.
You see it as a partnership.
Absolutely.
So, Ellen, you raised your hand. I think you wanted to say something and follow to that.
No, I just agree completely that that a union and an employer working together is a great thing, and I think everybody benefits.
So one of the things that I was fascinated about in revisiting 9 to 5, which I'm going to date myself, I remember seeing when it came out, right? And then rewatching a number of times over the years as a woman coming up. You talk in the book about the fact, so Jane Fonda gets involved in the movement, and that actually is what leads to the film. And at first, you're alarmed, 9 to 5, the organization is alarmed when it becomes a comedy. But the idea is this stuff is so over the top that if we tried to sell it as serious, no one would believe it, even though it is, right? So now fast forward to today, you're bringing back this thing called Bad Bosses, right? Which was a part of the book. You know, you'd go into detail about Bad Bosses contests you would hold. You're doing one tonight at the Harvard Bookstore. So are we back in the world of you can't make this stuff up?
I'm afraid we are, yes. So at the Harvard Bookstore tonight, December 8th at 7 p.m., I'm going to be talking about my book, Working 9 to 5. And as part of that, we're going to be holding a Dignity at Work contest where people are going to be asked to submit the worst thing they were ever asked to do by a boss. And I assume that we're going to hear from people saying things like what we heard back in the day, like the boss who asked his secretary to sew up a hole in his pants while he was wearing them, or the boss who fired a secretary for bringing a corned beef on white instead of rye, or the one who got a suspicious package in the mail and said to the secretary, you know, this could be a letter bomb, you open it. So we're hoping to get some entries that match those tonight, and I bet we will.
Okay, we're just going to drop the mic right there on that. So Ellen Cassidy is an advocate for women's rights in the workplace and author of the book Working 9 to 5, 50-year history of the 9 to 5 movement, and she will talk at 7 tonight at the Harvard Bookstore. Renee Dozier, IBEW Local 103, Carrie Barbash, president of the Harvard Union of Clerical and Technical Workers, all three of you, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
With our next guest's help, we have been regularly diving into the world of comics and the culture around them here on Radio Boston. Joel Christian Gill is the inaugural chair of the Boston University MFA program in visual narrative, who has been our guide into the world of comics. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
I also want to say that I'm finally learning how to pronounce the word inaugural correctly. How often we have you on the show. It's awesome. Could never say that word. So today we're going to talk about comic book shops and the community around those. So you've brought a guest with us. So the owner of Million Year Picnic in Cambridge, the oldest comic book shop in New England, Tony Davis, is here. Tony, welcome to Studio 2.
Thank you for having me. This is a wonderful experience.
It's really fun to have you, and I'm going to start with you. Okay, so I want you to set the scene a little bit. Million Year Picnic, one of the oldest comic book stores in the U.S., oldest in New England. Walk us in there. What do we see? What do we smell? What do we hear?
Your grandma's basement.
Take us there.
My wife says that the store has a particular smell, but I guess I'm immune to it by this point. I just remember the first time I walked in, which would have been summer of 1979, and it just had an amazing array of underground comics, mainstream comics, old, new. And I think of anything, you know, it's gotten better in the years. There's just so much interesting stuff coming out right now. And I feel like we have, you know, full sections of books by female and non-binary creators, LGBTQI+. Yes, plus. African-American creators. I just feel like there's so much more diversity, and there's so many books now, especially for younger readers, which I think there was a huge drought for about 20 to 30 years, where there just weren't books to bring kids into reading comics unless you started with superheroes. And that's not the whole world.
So the look and the feel may be the same, but the voices rising up out of the pages are far more diverse and by people who are far more diverse.
Correct. It's the same tiny space with wooden shelves and carpeting and all of that, but there are a lot more people now, a lot more people, I think, who can come into my store and see a reflection of themselves, a reflection of their cultural experiences, a reflection of their hopes and aspirations.
So, Joel, when we asked you, when we talked about this segment, and we knew we wanted to do comic book stores, you said Tony million years ago right away. You didn't even hesitate. So why? What makes it special to you?
Well, first of all, my foray into publishing starts with Tony.
Okay, then.
Tony started, he bought my first mini comic, and it was the first place my mini comics were sold in stores. So I automatically have a love for Million Year Picnic. But also, like, I describe Million Year Picnic as my version of Cheers. Right? I walk in and everybody knows who I am. Five more people are going to show up. I'm going to know who they are. And it's like a community, right? Like, I don't think I've ever gone to a Million Year Picnic and not seen somebody that I knew that are in comics. And also, like, you can get local creators. Like, are you looking for that kid who was making comics at this thing that you saw? You might find his comics in Million Year Picnic, right? And I think it's just like, you know, it's almost like the difference between, I always like, think about it as like, underground versus corporate, right? Corporate is really slick and smooth, and you might find everything you want. But if you really need something, you go to that mom and pop shop, yeah. Right? That's where you're going to get something that you really want. And I think Tony's shop is just that stop. That's just that shop where you can go in there and do that. And this isn't to say that Comicopia at BU is bad or Hub Comics is bad. I think if you're in that neighborhood, it's great. But for me, like, going in a Million Year Picnic is just really fantastic.
So I want to stay with that for a minute, Tony. You're the owner of Million Year Picnic, which is in Cambridge on Auburn Street. This idea that it's a place that you can belong, where, Joe, as you said, everybody knows your name. I was thinking about this, getting ready for today. I remember for a long time for me, that was the gym. But the first time I went into the gym, I was terrified because I didn't even know what the etiquette was. How do I behave? Are there questions I can and can't ask? Things I shouldn't touch, et cetera. So let's say people want to get to the point where they recognize Joel when he walks into Million Year Picnic, but they haven't walked in before. What is the etiquette? Like, how do you get into and operate respectfully in a comic book store?
Well, I think for most people, it's a fairly simple thing of seeing conversations going on, sort of becoming part of those conversations, learning and meeting people. I felt like from the first day I walked in the store when I was, I believe, 16, that it was easy to get to know people. And, one of the things that will happen quite frequently is that you'll be in the midst of a conversation and somebody else will throw in a great idea, someone you've never talked with before. So the hope is that on our best days, we're that kind of inclusive, that kind of friendly. Certainly Cheers comes to my mind, but also like the Black Barber Shop.
100.
The beauty salon. You know, the places where people go to take care of something, but at the same time, it's a social experience.
So that's not, I think, our common broad-based and maybe white, I don't know, cultural understanding of comic books. Here's a little bit of sound for you.
Oh, customers, how I hate them.
Excuse me, I just heard that before Spider-Man was a movie, it was a comic book. Is that possible?
What the... Suffering Steve Ditko! How can you not know that Spider-Man first appeared in 1962's classic Amazing Fantasy number 15? Yeah!
So Bart Simpson there trolling comic book guy in The Simpsons, and you were both cracking up.
We had a clerk for years, Hans, who used to joke that the character was based on him. So
okay, but that's not welcoming, Tony.
We definitely went through our Durgan Park, sort of rude Boston service period. I think we're a lot better than that.
So much better than that. Kelly's great.
Oh, Kelly is amazing.
Kelly's fantastic. Amazing.
And Will is really solid,
yeah.
Too.
And it's, comic, like, so the idea of how people, or people who are interested in comics has changed, right? It used to be nerds, right? Like, if you were a nerd and you're in comics. But what happened is those people typically ended up being smart and making a lot of money and basically influencing culture, right? So now you've got people, it's like comics are cool, right? Like, it wasn't cool when I was a kid. It wasn't as cool, right? I always thought they were cool. But it's becoming a much more like there are people out there, people who are listening right now who are saying, I always wanted to get into comics.
Right.
Well, go to Million Year Picnic and ask Kelly what's a good comic to read. Ask Tony ask somebody, like somebody who's walking in there. They'll tell you. Like, and I think that the thing that, being an evangelist for comics is what, as I am, and I say all the time, like, comics are stories that is a medium that anybody can get into. It just depends on what kind of stories you like. And so, like, in a store like Tony's, has all of those store has all those stories. You've got, you know, European comics, you've got indie comics, you've got superhero, you've got classic, you've got nonfiction, you've got a lot of different things. And I think in a space that's 700 square feet, right? That's part of the charm of it, because those intimate conversations that Tony was talking about are related to the fact that you're going to be almost standing next to somebody else. And so when you're talking, somebody else is going to overhear that.
So we're speaking with Joel Christian Gill, who's the inaugural chair of the Boston University MFA program in visual narrative, and Tony Davis, who's the owner of Million Year Picnic in Cambridge. And we've just been talking about what can be the magic of a comic book store. You were talking about new stories, Joel, and while you were speaking, you saw me doing this. You guys brought in a few things. I actually took pictures of them and tweeted them while we were talking, so that if anybody awesome. Wants to go to my Twitter account, @Tiziana_Deering, and see these while we're talking, they can. Tell us, pick one of these. And Tony, you first. Pick what you brought in and tell us a little bit about it.
Well, I brought the Million Year Picnic in, which is the a collection of EC comic stories from the 1950s that Fantagraphics published. And I think used the title sort of as a love letter to the store and its founding owner, Jerry Weiss. Jerry was an old school science fiction superhero comic fan, but at the same time got turned on to S. Clay Wilson and Robert Crumb and the sort of classic underground comics of the day, loved Crazy Cat, loved Little Nemo, someone who was an all-around comics fan. And The Million Year Picnic is the title of the last chapter of Ray Bradbury's Martian Chronicles. Jerry was a huge Ray Bradbury fan, and the first comic book he bought had that story in it, and he carried that with him, that essence of EC Comics, his entire life.
So if I wanted to take a little tour through some comic history in a way that might ground me, this book, The Million Year Picnic and Other Stories, could be a good way to do that. Is that right?
It would certainly take you back to a particular time when genre comics like horror and science fiction and fantasy were a regular part of the comic book tapestry. And they are again. There was a fairly large period of time where superheroes dominated everything. Many of the other publishers went away, but we're living in a renaissance period now where there's so many amazing titles coming out from a vast array of publishers. And it's making my shelves creak and groan. And we've run out of space to put new things, but we somehow find a way to do it.
So, Joel, it's interesting that Tony says that about there was a time when it was superhero dominant, less so now, because you've brought two things here, one superhero oriented and one not. So where do you want to start?
So let's start with Fantastic Four Full Circle.
Which is the superhero
which is super,
oriented
superhero.
One.
And Alex Ross was my favorite as a kid because he was a painting. He painted all of these comics and painted this really amazing series called Marvels, and then he painted Kingdom Come. But then he did this really interesting story that was a story by Stanley and Jack Kirby that's just really fun. It's just a great, it's on a number of top comics list of 2022, and I wanted to broaden it because I know some of you people here know how I feel about superhero comics sometimes. I throw a lot of shade.
But this one's good. You like this one.
Yeah, this
why?
One's good.
Okay, so why does this
get
shade?
It's not beating up poor people. You know, it's it's not a superhero beating up poor people. And it's sort of, you know, Fantastic Four has a tendency to be more science fiction based anyway. Their problems are bigger and more spectacular. They don't like usually go and fight, you know, street crime. And I think that's really good. But it's like on a number of best list this year.
It's
gorgeous. Yeah,
it's
stunning. Yeah. Alex Ross is pretty amazing, and it captures like the feel. It's like an updated feel of a 1960s comic, which I think is really great. And the other book I bought was Ducks by Kate Beaton. If you're not familiar with Harka Vagrant, Kate Beaton is just a brilliant cartoonist. And this is her memoir. And
this is a big book.
It's really fantastic. I mean, some of the devices in which she's telling stories in here are pretty amazing. And as we are close to the holiday season, these are some of the books that I think people should be looking out for. And Watch Day, which we talked about earlier this year, which I think is still a fantastic standout from the, you know, of 2022. But that book is just told. It's just a poignant story. It's interesting. Kate Beaton has really sort of grown into like just little, you know, funny, like, random comics that she's been doing into something that's really big, and I think this was a really amazing book.
So three recommendations for this year if you're shopping for somebody who either is or wants to become a comic lover. We've got Fantastic Four Full Circle by Alex Ross. We've got Ducks, 2 Years in the Oil Sands by Kate Beaton, and The Million Year Picnic and Other Stories by Will Elder. So the next thing I want to ask you, Tony, is how to start, right? So let's draw an analogy. Let's say somebody wants to get interested in, I don't know, wine or beer or something like that, right? They don't even know what's the right first price to pay for a bottle and how do I know if it tastes good, et cetera. So if somebody wants to make that first purchase, tell them a little bit about how to figure out what a good first purchase is.
Fights, One Boy's Triumph Over Violence.
By Joel Christian Gill.
A brilliant book.
Which we've covered, by the way. We can throw the link up. We've covered this with you. It is a brilliant book. We talked through it. We'll put that link on our website again at Radio Boston. Go ahead.
I mean, people come into the store all the time who are just getting into comics, and all they really need to do is say, here are a few things I'm interested in. I'm looking for something slice of life. I like biographies. I like history. I like science fiction. I like fantasy. I actually spend countless hours talking to an intermediary, talking to a parent or a brother or a sister, trying to figure out what their loved ones would like in the form of a comic book. And I feel like nowadays there's something for everyone. Like you mentioned beer and wine. There's a comic book guide to beer. There's a graphic history of wine.
I did not see that coming.
So, you know, there's something for everybody. And so basically when you go in, go to the person at the counter and say, look, I'm new to this. Maybe you could suggest a few things to me. Maybe you could walk around with me and show me a few things in the shop. A lot of times I'll leave people with a stack of 10, 15, 20 books. And I'll say, why don't you go through them, see what connects with you. And even people who are longtime comic book people who come into the store, you know, when people get ready to leave, I always ask, did you find what you were looking for? And a not uncommon answer is, I found something I wasn't even looking for. And that's the beauty of being able to browse a store, of having things catch your eye, but also being able to interact. Sometimes when people ask for recommendations, I'll throw it out to the floor. You know, if I've got a couple of people in my shop.
A bit of crowdsourcing on the floor.
Yeah, and I'll say, hey, do you know something that might work with this person? And people usually find more than one thing that they're happy with that's going to be a fulfilling read for them. So,
all right. I think we're just going to stop it right there. Tony Davis is owner of Million Year Picnic in Cambridge, New England's oldest comic book shop. Joel Christian Gill, inaugural chair of Boston University's MFA program in visual narrative, our guide through the world of comics and culture in Greater Boston. Tony, great to meet you. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
And Joel, as always, thanks.
Thank you.
And that's our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Chris Siderick, Amanda Beland, and Sydney Bowles, with Bart Tachi, Rob Lane today, and Andrea Perdomo Hernandez. Marquise Neal is our senior technical director, Titus Faladun, our executive producer. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thanks for tuning in. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.